Evidence and Answers begins right now. This is Evidence and Answers radio broadcast with our host, Pat Zukran. Pat is an author, teacher, and international speaker in the area of Christian apologetics, the defense of the Christian faith. In this episode of Paratus, we explore the central proof of Christ's divinity, the resurrection. Dr. Holden and Dr. Zukran unpack the historical evidence, biblical prophecy, and theological significance of the resurrection, addressing skeptical arguments and comparing it to pagan myths. Listen in today as we discover why the resurrection is not only foundational to Christian faith, but also the supreme apologetic of Jesus. Now let's get right into part one of this two-part discussion regarding the proof of Jesus's divinity.
Joining me on the broadcast is Dr. Joseph Holden, author and pastor and president of Veritas International University, and Dr. Patrick Zukran, author of The Apologetics of Jesus and co-founder of Evidence and Answers. Joe, Pat, it's great to be with you today.
Good to be with you, Brian.
Well, during this new season on Paratus, we're discussing apologetics, specifically looking at the apologetics of Jesus. In our first broadcast of this series, we investigated Jesus' use of testimony as an apologetic tool. On our last broadcast, we looked at Jesus' use of miracles as a means of confirmation for his divinity. On this episode, we'll look at the central proof of Christ's claims, the resurrection. The resurrection affirms that Christ defeated sin and death. Furthermore, the resurrection has been a part of the Christian's defense of the faith since its inception and was Christ's supreme apologetic that confirmed his claim. So, to say the least, it's a huge topic. So, Joe, I thought we'd start with you by normally doing what we do, and that's define our terms. Can you tell us what exactly a resurrection is, and how does it differ from, let's say, a resuscitation? And then kind of as a follow-up question, what evidence do we have that the resurrection actually occurred?
Well, Brian, our definition of resurrection comes from the Bible, and it comes from a Greek term, anastasis, which is the word most often used to describe or used for the word in English, resurrection. And it's a compound word. It comes from two words, ana and histemi. Ana means up, histemi means to stand. And literally, resurrection means to stand up. So in Christian theology, when we refer to the resurrection, it is referring to a dead person coming back to life in their body, and the body has changes in it, and it becomes a glorified body. So that's why we refer to Christ's resurrection as a resurrection and not a reincarnation nor a resuscitation. But when you start to compare these other terms with a resurrection that we read about in Scripture, such as a resuscitation is different than a resurrection in that the person is raised back to life who was formerly dead, but they're raised back into the same mortal body that will one day die again in the future. I think most of us remember the story of Lazarus in John chapter 11, how he was a resuscitation, and we call him a resuscitation, coming back to life from the dead in his same mortal body, because Christ is our first fruits from the dead. 1 Corinthians 15 tells us that Christ is going to be the first one resurrected from the dead, not Lazarus. So that's why we call Lazarus and all those resurrected before Christ a resuscitation. That body that Lazarus had is going to be the same temporal, mortal, corruptible and finite body that will one day die again. And then you have another term that we're often confused by, and that's reincarnation. Reincarnation is when a dead person comes back to life in a different body altogether. It's a total change of the body. It could be an animal body, it could be an insect, it could be another individual person. And there is much in the church that seems to understand the Christian resurrection in terms of a reincarnation, but we got to get rid of that kind of thinking, because the biblical resurrection means you have your same body that came out of the grave, and it will be forever immortal and incorruptible, strong, dominated by the Spirit of God, and live forever, never to die again. And so you have this difference within these terms. If you want to make it more simple, reincarnation is a change of body, whereas a resurrection is a change in body, never to die again. But with these definitions, when we say somebody has to die again, when they're resuscitated, like Lazarus, they bring up Hebrews chapter 9, verse 27, that tells us it's appointed for man once to die, then the judgment. We might be thinking, how can Lazarus die twice? Isn't that anti-biblical? Doesn't it go against the word of God? Well, no, because Hebrews 9 is a general principle. Generally, people only die once. That's the whole human history of people. Most people just die once, not twice. But there are exceptions, such as Lazarus and others who were resuscitated from the dead. So that is a very important key terms to distinguish from the resurrection.
Yeah, so good. And such an important distinction, as you said, defining it for us in that way. So Joe, again, kind of as a follow-up, now that we understand what a resurrection actually is, biblically speaking, do we have any evidence that Jesus actually rose from the dead?
Well, the evidence stacks up in our favor, Brian, because we have a whole body of literature that describes the different points of evidence that we can draw upon. The first evidence, which is very key and powerful, is the eyewitnesses. They wrote it down. They saw and experienced the resurrection. They saw the risen Lord. They touched him. They ate with him. And that this body of evidence is preserved in the Gospels and the epistles. You have the Gospel of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, in whom they consulted eyewitnesses in the case of Mark and Luke. And then you have Matthew and John, who actually experienced the resurrected Lord himself. They all documented these appearances, the eyewitnesses. In fact, if you go to 1 Corinthians 15, you find Paul in that epistle, written about 54, 55 AD. He says that over 500 people saw Christ, and most of them still remained alive at the time he wrote 1 Corinthians 15, which was, again, 54, 55. This was a couple decades after Jesus had already risen from the dead. And the appearances, secondly, of Christ, he was handled, he was touched, he invited himself to be touched. In John chapter 20, he said to Thomas, who has a little problem with believing unless he touched the risen Lord, he said, "Touch me. Put your hands in the holes in my hands and put your finger in the hole in my side." And Thomas just drops to his knees and says, "My Lord and my God." Certainly no doubt after that. And then in Luke 24, he appears to the disciples and says, "I am not a spirit, for a spirit doesn't have flesh and bones as you see I have. Handle me and see." And then he says, "Give me a piece of broiled fish." And then he ate this piece of fish before them to show them that he had actually risen from the dead. He was not just a ghost. And I think about the changed lives of the disciples. They went from cowards to lions. They went from worshiping on Saturday to Sunday. They went from kosher food to thinking that all things were available to them in a very short time. The only event that could probably account for these radical changes in the disciples would be the resurrection of Christ from the dead. In fact, most of these apostles went and died for their faith as martyrs. And people don't die for what they know to be false. They die for what they know to be true. Nobody dies for a lie, but you have people dying for what they think is true. And there was no recanting of this message of the gospel, that Christ died, he rose again, and they went to their graves believing that thing. And this is powerful because we don't even see in the first century, Brian, we have no refutation of the gospel message of the resurrection of Christ in that first century. If it was a lie and they were promoting a hoax, wouldn't you think that there would be some rebuttal to this? But we don't see it. It's virtually absent. So we have many things that can confirm that Christ really rose from the dead. It can go on and on. But in the short time we have together, we have to make it a finite list at this point.
Yeah, but those are powerful witnesses. Eyewitness, change lives, people willing to die actually happened. So thanks for that, Joe. You've given us a definition and you've provided evidence that the resurrection actually occurred. So Patrick, I'm going to move to you now. Even with the evidence that Joe just provided, many will deny the resurrection. They will state that it never actually happened, or at least how Christians portray it as such. So can you give our listeners a summary of some of these main arguments against the resurrection, and then maybe just a little bit of explanation as why those arguments fall short?
Yes, over the years, people have tried to give alternative explanations for the empty tomb and the preaching of the gospel that, as Joe mentioned, began in Jerusalem. I mean, that's in the most hostile arena you could have picked to concoct some kind of story of the resurrection, because all the eyewitnesses are there. The people who crucified Christ are still there. They haven't gone anywhere. And the religious leaders were looking to stomp out the memory of Jesus. Because one of the things that Jesus was saying is that if indeed what he claimed about himself is true, then their religious system was coming to an end. He fulfills the sacrificial mandates, the requirements. He fulfills the law, and their religious system was coming to an end. So they wanted to stomp it out. And so they were trying to give an alternative explanation to the empty tomb. But somehow you have to account for all the facts that Joe just mentioned, and many of the alternative explanations have failed. The oldest one, of course, comes in Matthew 28, that the disciples stole the body while the guards were sleeping, and that one really hasn't held much water. Could 11 men come at night and slip past the guards and roll a 1,000, 2,000-pound stone up an incline in complete silence? That's really a faulty kind of explanation. And then we've had some recent ones that came out in the 19th and some even in the 20th, 21st century. I think Kersop Lake tried to introduce one that says the women went to the wrong tomb. Of course, then all the authorities would have to do is go to the correct tomb and produce the body. We had the famous one, the swoon theory. Jesus never really died, but went unconscious on the cross and was mistakenly thought he had died. Well, that hasn't carried much weight. Pretty easy to identify a dead body. And could Jesus survive 3 days, three nights without any medical attention, food or water? And even if he did, could he roll away a stone? And how would he have appeared to his disciples, in that condition? Would he have appeared as the glorious risen Savior, the victor over death? I think they would have looked at him and said, "Hey, buddy, you need some help. Let's get you some medical attention quick." The only one really that's left is that the disciples had a hallucination, some kind of dream or vision that Jesus was alive and went, preaching in the streets that Jesus was alive. And really, in all the debates I have heard, really, that's the only one that's left standing. And of course, that one has a lot of problems. Psychologists, psychiatrists know that hundreds of people don't have the same hallucination at the same time. Hallucination occurs to people that really want to see that person again or that event to be true. And you had people like Thomas, who said, "Unless I see, I won't believe." You had Paul, who persecuted the Christians and trying to stomp them out. But that's the only one that's left. And if the disciples simply had a dream or vision, all the authorities would have to do is go to the tomb, because they knew where it was, produce the body, and that's the end of Christianity. But really, that's the only one that's really left that I'll hear in debates. We've had recent ones. John Dominic Crossan, one of the leaders of the Jesus Seminar, offered a theory that Jesus was buried in a shallow grave and wild dogs dug up and ate the body of Jesus. Well, why do we have to wait 2,000 years for that explanation? why wasn't a contemporary offering that? We had to wait 2,000 years for that one. And it doesn't match the facts that the Gospels lay out, that Jesus was buried in a tomb cut in a rock in a cave, and no one refuted those accounts there. They even identify Joseph of Arimathea, prominent member of the Jewish council. And so all the theories really have failed. The argument that many give is that, well, it's a miracle and miracles don't happen. Well, if God exists and there's good reasons and good arguments that indeed we live in a theistic universe, if God exists, if there can be a God who can act, you can have acts of God. And so if God exists, miracles are possible. And Jesus was the divine Son of God. And you know, if God created the universe out of nothing, it's really no problem for God to resuscitate his body from the dead. So really all alternative explanations have really failed to account for all the facts regarding the resurrection that Job presented, that really all sides agree on. Liberal, evangelical, agnostic, atheists agree on those facts, and these alternative explanations really fail to account for all the facts.
Thanks for that. It's a great summary, Patrick. Appreciate it. Well, Joe, I'll go back to you. You know, the reality of the resurrection was not totally hidden. And I'll just give two examples here. One, Jesus predicted it. He said he was going to rise from the dead. And two, it was also prophesied in the Bible. And so though many people say that this was kind of came out of left field, a surprise, but it really didn't, because it was talked about in the Bible. So can you unpack these two aspects of the resurrection, that first of all, Jesus predicted it, and secondly, that it was prophesied?
Yes, absolutely, Brian. You know, when we look to the Old Testament, we're comforted knowing that God all along was showing his people that there would be a Messiah that would come, he would suffer death, and then he would rise again from the dead. And then, as you said, Jesus predicted it again in the New Testament. I think of Isaiah 53, and you see in verses 8 through 10, it speaks of the Messiah who will be killed. It says, for he was cut off from the land of the living. But then as you go on the next couple verses, it says, but he shall see his seed, he shall prolong his days, he shall see the labor of his soul and be satisfied. That speaks of his life afterwards. So yes, he would suffer, but also he would have life afterwards. And then I love Zechariah 12:10, where it, during the second coming, it shows how Christ will appear physically again. It says, they will look upon me whom they have pierced. This is speaking of when Christ comes back to Jerusalem and to Israel in the second coming, that they will finally recognize that they have put their Messiah to death. And it goes on to talk about they will mourn like they're mourning for the death of their firstborn son. It will be so traumatic. But then again, you have Psalm 16, especially in verse 10. It says, for you will not leave my soul in Sheol, nor will you allow your Holy One to see corruption, speaking of the Messiah there, the Holy One. And the Apostle Peter, interestingly, takes Psalm 16 and uses it in his convincing sermon to those who are trying to understand what is happening with the pouring out of the Spirit and so forth in Acts chapter 2. And he applies this verse to the resurrection of Christ. And so he goes through this elaborate argument saying that this couldn't have spoken, this verse, Psalm 16, couldn't have spoken of King David in the past because we still have his tomb with us today. He is still in the grave today. And the prophecy is that your Holy One would not see corruption or decay in the tomb, but that he wouldn't be left in the grave, but he would rise up out of the grave. So he goes to great lengths showing us that Psalm 16 was a prophecy that applied to Jesus himself. And then I love the instance when Jesus is challenged by the religious authorities in Jerusalem, and they say, well, give us a sign that you're a Messiah. And what does Jesus do? He says, no sign will be given to you except the sign of Jonah. Just as Jonah was 3 days and three nights in the belly of the great fish, so also the Son of Man will be in the heart of the earth 3 days and three nights, pointing to his resurrection. There would be a limited time, only 3 days, that he would be in this tomb. And then after that, we know what happens, the resurrection. But it doesn't stop there. It goes on to Jesus predicting prophetically that he will rise from the dead in the New Testament as well. I think one instance that's pretty familiar to all of us is in John chapter 2, where Jesus is cleansing the temple and he's challenged by the religious authorities to say, "What authority do you have to do this?" And Jesus responds, "Destroy this temple and in 3 days I will raise it up." Again, speaking of the temple of his body, the resurrection. And then you have Matthew and Mark, especially in Matthew 17, where you find Jesus saying that I must be delivered and betrayed into the hands of evil men. They will kill the Messiah, me, the Messiah, he would say. And on the third day, he will be raised up. So over and over again, both in the Old and the New Testament, the prophets predicted it of old. And in the New Testament, Jesus continued to prophesy of his resurrection in the new. In fact, when he rose from the dead, the disciples still didn't quite understand this whole story of death and resurrection, a suffering Messiah. So an angel had to point them back in their memory. Do you not remember when he told you that he would have to suffer at the hands of evil men, be in the grave 3 days, and then rise again? And so in time, the disciples grasped onto this notion of the suffering death and then this great glorious resurrection of Christ.
Beautiful. Thanks for that, Joe. And the powerful witness, the evidence for the resurrection, just in this first 20 minutes, it's stacking up. Of course, Joe, you defined for us what a resurrection is and then gave us evidence. And then Patrick dismantled some of the common theories that are thrown out there. And then, Joe, you just pointed out that Jesus predicted that he would rise from the dead, but the Bible also prophesies that Jesus will rise from the dead. This is a lot of weight behind the reality of the resurrection. So my question to you, Patrick, is being all this weight, being all this evidence there for us, how does this help fulfill the law? Why does the resurrection even matter?
Yeah, great question, Brian. You know, God is a God of love, but also many people forget within God, there's a perfect balance of holiness and justice. And a loving God who is a just God, who is a holy God, just can't dismiss sin. One of the things that make Christianity unique is that Christianity takes a very serious understanding of sin. You know, you just can't dismiss it. There's certain forms of Buddhism that you just kind of dismisses sin when you chant to the Buddha. That wasn't in Buddha's original teachings, but I mean, you just can't dismiss it. Holy and just God requires payment for sin. You know, it would be like if I had committed a serious crime, if I got drunk, drove a car and ran over a family, and then I appeared in court and the judge said, "You know, Pat, you look like a nice guy. I'm just going to dismiss everything." Well, that's not loving. That's not just. And so God taking sin seriously, there needed to be payment or atonement for sin. And according to the Old Testament law, that came through the shedding of blood. Hebrews 9 says, you know, without the shedding of blood, there is no forgiveness of sin. And Hebrews chapter 10 goes on to talk about the sacrifice of Christ, how the sacrifice of cattle and sheep was only a shadow, a future picture prophecy of the perfect lamb who would one day come and make the perfect sacrifice once and for all and end the sacrificial system. Because Hebrews 10 says the blood of lambs could not fulfill the atonement required for the forgiveness of all sin. So it had to continually be made year after year. Well, with Christ's sacrifice being God, he could die for all mankind. Being God, he was sinless. So he was the perfect sacrifice to atone for the sins of all mankind, ending the sacrificial system and fulfilling the law.
Once again, we've run out of time. Thank you for joining us here on Evidence and Answers. Our goal is to bring you the love of Christ and to equip you in your faith to always be ready to give a response. If you would like to hold an apologetics conference or series of teachings at your facility, contact Pat by calling him in Hawaii. That number is 483-0586. Or you may email him through the Evidence and Answers website. That's evidenceandanswers.org. Be sure to browse through our listing of topics on our site. We have everything from atheism to Zen Buddhism. You will also find articles and additional audio for you to listen to or download. An additional location to find Pat's messages is on YouTube. Look up Evidence and Answers and hit the subscribe button. To keep quality broadcasts like Pat's on the air, we rely on generous financial support from you, our listeners. Donating is simple. Just log on at evidenceandanswers.org. Evidence and Answers is grateful for one of our sponsors, the Honolulu Christian Church. If you don't have a home church and are looking for a place to grow in your faith, check out the Honolulu Christian Church. For service times, log in at honoluluchristian.org. Join us again next time on the air or online as we provide compelling reasons for faith in Christ. That's Evidence and Answers with Pat Zukeran.